Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life. In this episode, Ilona sits down with Paul Michael of Peter Michael Winery.
So yes, and he was staying at the Fairmont Hotel, and so was Peggy Lee, and she was going to sing there that evening. So he was at a loose end, so the story goes, and he liked Peggy Lee, and so he sat down and to listen to her sing, and ordered a bottle of Burgundy white, which is what he loved to drink, in terms of white wine, and they brought it, and it was corked. It wasn't right, and so was the second bottle. So then he said, "Well, bring something local. What do the locals make?" And they brought a bottle of Chateau Montelena and a Chardonnay, and he tasted it and thought, "This is very good." And so that was his introduction to Californian wine. And he then also found himself, I think, up in this area and discovered how beautiful it is at one weekend, and driving around. And he'd been invited up, I think, to visit his partner up here, and who had a ranch up in Healdsburg. And so he got lost on the way, as you do, coming up this far, but discovered how beautiful it is. And I think that was really his introduction to this part of the world and the wine country. And I guess he became one of the few Englishmen at the time to know that something rather special was going on. And he watched it sort of unfurl. And about around that time, I think the Judgment of Paris happened, that famous tasting.
76.
Organized by Stephen Spurrier. And so he noticed that. Not many people did at the time in England, but he did, and so he was in the right place at the right time, and so he started a search for a property around here. He thought it'd be a good idea to invest a little into a little bit of America anyway. England back in the 1970s, the future was uncertain, the economy was not great, and so he just thought this would be a good place to invest. And wine would be a good vehicle, and he loved wine. He was taken through the vineyards of France as a teenager by his parents, my grandparents. I guess that would have been in the '50s. And you know, my grandfather used to go and taste and buy wine, stuff it in the car, and take it back over the Channel. And that would keep him in wine for the year. And my father and my aunt would tag along. And so I guess he picked up a bit along the way. And I always had wine, great wines, on the table from a young age. And I was being sent down to the cellar to select wines, which I now look back on and realize some of those were very good wines, very, you know, proper Burgundy wines, for example, in Bordeaux. As well, so he that was how my introduction to wine came along and developed slowly. Anyway, he was searching for years, I think, really, at least 6 years, for a property up here. He knew he wanted something which wasn't too far from San Francisco Airport, but he didn't want to really be right in the middle of Napa Valley either. That was a little bit too busy. He wanted to be able to come and relax and so eventually, after visiting many properties, he found this property, and so that's how his story started. So, and I was my brother and I, we were at school in England, had summer holidays coming up. We were due to go on a safari holiday in Africa, in Kenya, actually. And I was 17, my brother was 15, and we had some friends with us who were going to come, one friend each. And at the last minute, there was a military coup in Nairobi, And so we all gathered around the kitchen table, and like just a few days before we were due to go. And it was basically, listen, boys, we're not going to be going to Kenya, but Dad's got this idea of, why don't we go to California and see, you know, visit San Francisco, stay there, and come up to the wine country as well. So that's how we found ourselves in the Silverado Country Club in 1982. Staying there, amusing ourselves. Mum and Dad would go off in the car and each day, and we didn't really care where they were going to, because we were teenagers having a good time together. And but then one day, you know, we were bundled into this Cadillac and brought up here from the Silverado Country Club. And the further away we got, it, the more bewildered we got, because more and more countryside. And we turned off this road here, the 128, and it's pretty quiet up here today, but it was even quieter then. And we came onto this property, and there was no winery here. There was a Victorian era house, unoccupied, and we drove past that, and we drove up into the middle of the property, past a cabin, a derelict cabin, and again unoccupied, and ended up sort of a mile up this track, which was very eroded, and got out, and the poor car wasn't probably the same again after that, getting up there, because it was completely eroded track and completely overgrown track. And anyway, got out and surveyed the scene, and we're by the reservoir there, and which was overgrown at the time, but it was very beautiful, the whole area, and really that's where we learnt what my parents had been doing for the last few days, and they'd closed the deal to buy this property, and I think he'd been working on it for since the year before, and he'd found it then. And with the help of another friend, a family friend, called Angela Rubin, who assisted in looking at many properties. And this one appealed because of it, where it's located, very beautiful, mountain behind us, and it had water on it, and hillsides. And one of the things that he knew was that a hillside was important. And of course, at the time, most of the plantings were on the valley floor, and very few hillside plantings. That was only for the bold and the brave. And he knew water was really important. So we were told that we would be coming back in the spring and planting the first vines, my brother and I. Well, exactly when he said we, what he precisely meant was my brother and I, and we were back in the following April 83 and planted the first vines, and those vines were Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot and Cabernet Franc at the time, to make a nice Bordeaux style red from California, a claret, and that was to become Les Pavots, which we'll taste here in a little while. So that was the original plan, and they did up the house, the main house, which is on a little hill overlooking the road here, and we did up the cabin the following year, and so my parents have stayed in that house ever since when they're here on property, and I and my family and my kids stay at the cabin, and my kids have grown up getting to know this property, so it's always been there as far as they're concerned. But when we were here, there really wasn't much here, and I don't think my father in his wildest dreams realised it would be quite the success that it became and become so well known in the world. A bit of luck came along on the way, but we sat out on the deck up in that main house, evening after evening, talking about the plan and what we were going to call this winery. And what the philosophy would be. So what are we going to call the winery? And Peter Michael Winery was his idea. My father, being a modest man, he said, we'll call it Peter Michael Winery, which isn't necessarily that sort of English thing to do, but it was a great idea. And he wanted it to be recognized as a, you know, he wanted the wine label to be recognized across the room very easily, but at the same time with an understated label as well. And so all those things were being discussed. And then the philosophy was developed by my father and Helen Turley, our first winemaker, who joined a little while later. But what he did know from the start was that he wanted to make a classical wine, grown on a hillside. He wanted to be a balanced and elegant wine, in the style that France is known for, and so that's always been the driving force behind what we do. And then a little later on, we developed another facet to that approach, and that is called the 100 by 100, which basically describes our long-term commitment to making these wines in the way we make them, handmade wines, long-term decision making, everything that's necessary to in the vineyard in particular, to make these classical wines. So that's how it started. And so we planted those first vines. Helen Turley joined us probably in 87 as the first vintage was coming along, but she may have joined earlier, I'm not entirely sure. She was pretty well known at the time. Again, nowhere near as famous as she was to become as a winemaker. Mm-hmm. And these red grapes weren't ready. So those vines were still too young. The first vintage of Le Pavot was actually 1988, and the first mm-hmm. release of Le Pavot was 1989. But our first wine we ever made was in 1987. And that was it was called Mon Plaisir. It was a Chardonnay, and it wasn't estate grown. It came from the Gower Ranch, which is then became known as Alexander Mountain Estate. So up in Alexander Valley on the hillsides there. And that was a very small quantity of that was made. It was well received, and it was a beautiful Chardonnay. So that's where we started, and I think although we don't have Mon Plaisir in front of us here, we do have a Chardonnay, which is estate grown, and perhaps it's time to taste one of the wines. Yeah.
And while we're tasting it, I do have a question. So your dad clearly was deeply engaged in Silicon Valley business, which spells innovation. It's all about pushing forward. And when he discovered, thank God for lack of GPS, this lovely area and decided subsequently to pursue it, it strikes me as interesting because this is farming. This is as old world and as old fashioned as it gets. It's a complete different end of spectrum, and it's hard work. And he clearly had many choices of what he would have pursued outside of his chosen profession. What do you think motivated him to come here, besides the natural beauty and the fact that he was very, he's a visionary, really. I mean, to be predisposed to California wine with such a short history at the time, as far as the world knew, bespeaks the depth of his thinking and perception.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, when I can remember thinking when my father said, "We're going to make some Californian wine. We're going to grow some grapes and make some Californian wine." You know, we knew Californian wine in the UK because it was widely advertised on television, but it was wine in a came in a little box with a tap on it, right? And that's what we all associated Californian wine with at the time. So we didn't associate it with Napa Valley special wines. And never heard of Sonoma Valley or Sonoma County. There was a certain question amongst us as why do you want to do that, Dad? Mm-hmm. And I think many of his friends also said, Pete, why do you want to do that? We surely should just go to France and pick up a chateau, which you could do at that time in those days. He likes a challenge. Oh. Still does. He's a natural entrepreneur. I think he knows how he's been pretty successful at picking a good team to help him. There is a story that the president of the winery is Scott Rowley. Mm-hmm. And Scott was the real estate vendor at the time. He was the agent or broker between mm-hmm. the two sides. And so my father says that he said, Scott, I'll do this, but I'll only do this if you'll become president for us. Mm-hmm. So he knew if he was going to do this, he had to have some good people around him mm-hmm. To do it, bearing in mind that also doing it an absentee, he wasn't here. He was living in the UK. He was running a public company at the time. Yeah. So he was a busy guy, and my parents would come here two or three times a year for about a month each time. There was a big old fax machine in a cupboard here, and one back in the UK, and reams of paper would come out at either end, and that's how he managed it in those early days. I think knowing that, why not go and buy in France, for example? Why not make it, do it in the easy way? I think he's always believed there's no point in doing something if it's easy. Lots of people can do that. I think he also saw the time. There was something special happening here, and bear in mind he travelled, he'd seen a bit of the world by then. And the climate, here, in perhaps this is the most important point that I should have said first, really. Making wine in California, you have this consistent climate, and you don't generally have to worry about rain or frost. And you've got this consistency with your product. Especially in those days, technology has come on today, but in those days, the climate was really, really important in that sense.
Absolutely. And again, he could have, in the 6 years that he was looking, I'm sure that he looked at a lot of different properties. He could have chosen the valley floor. He could have chosen something easier, but it's sort of this layering on of how do I find something that's the most challenging, and then on top of it, the absentee ownership, which means you have to have a ton of faith in your team. And we're talking late 70s, early 80s, that really is something that's even more remarkable, because Valley at the time was pretty barren relative to what it is today. So there's no reference points really outside of a few big producers. And given the background and given the depth and breadth of the wine engagement on the consumer side that you described early on, mm-hmm. clearly there was a lot of awareness of what it would take to produce wine of that quality. So your dad is trying to sound like not just a remarkable individual, but a very unique one in his point of view and vision.
Yes, a lot of people have said that. He was described as this crazy Englishman planting vineyards on a hillside, spending way too much money planting vineyards on a hillside, which is something we've done time and again since then, of course. So I as I say, I think he thought hillsides was important. Now, when we say hillsides, where we are actually is really, you should call it a mountainside.
Yeah.
We're on a mountain here. This is not a little hill. Whether I wasn't, you know, part of that.
Yeah.
But I think he understood enough to know that to make it that elegant and balanced wine, you need high, those Dionne shifts. They're greater up there. You've got, you're going to have higher acidity, a better chance of making an elegant wine. And
where does this confidence come from in a man that obviously has been remarkably successful in other realms, but hasn't attempted agriculture and viticulture in particular? You have to have some courage there, a lot of it, and a lot of self-awareness.
Yep. Yes.
Some humility, probably.
Oh yes, but a lot of all that. A lot of it. So you'd have to ask him. I haven't figured that out myself.
There must be some family of origin references there, because usually, you know, well, from childhood we learn by osmosis. There has to be mm-hmm. some foundational pieces there
yeah.
that enable him to become, you know, someone that was so aware of so many things. There was no conversations back in the day about diurnal temperature shift or hillside fruit or any of that. Mm. That came much later.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he was at the very beginning, basically a pioneer in many respects, again, without having any other information to rely on.
Yeah.
It's pretty remarkable.
Well, thank you. I think he was probably taken also by the scenery.
The romance.
The romance of the place. And of course, romance and wine go together very well. You've got a mountain backdrop here. It is a beautiful place to come to, and he was looking for that. And I said a lot of luck came along as well. And some of that luck played out with the Chardonnay. Mm-hmm. So please taste. We've got a La Carrière.
Yes.
We've got a La Carrière 2014 here in the glass. This is actually, talking about the size, this is the one of the steepest of our vineyards. In fact, it is the steepest. It's got up to a 40% slope in some spots. Beautiful view over Knights Valley, and which is where this is the AVA we're in. We're in Knights Valley AVA.
Yeah.
And La Carrière means quarry in French. So the French naming was what part of that philosophy, you know, again, to reflect the classical winemaking approach and where our inspirations come from. And quarry, very suitably named because it's probably the steepest, it's the rockiest of our vineyards. And this is estate grown. And when you raise this glass to your nose, you've got some wonderful minerality in there.
I was just thinking that.
I'm not sure people were talking about minerality back then either. But
they still don't know much about it, turns out. As recent debates would suggest, that could be a misnomer. Maybe you can chime in on this a bit, Peter.
Well, our first Chardonnays that we made were from the Gower Ranch. And uh-huh. they were made pretty much the same way this wine is made. So barrel fermented, indigenous yeast fermentation, extensive lees contact, and bottled unfined and unfiltered. And that basic recipe has been with the winery since the first vintage in 1987. What was always different about the wine that came from Gower is it did not have that crushed oyster shells, sea salt kind of minerality that you see in the Chardonnays that we have from Knights Valley. as the project developed, we ended up going away from sourcing anything at Gower and actually created a Mont Plaisir block here on the estate, spent several vintages transitioning it over, and the biggest change in the wine was the addition of that minerality. So there's something going on this property that leads to that mineral expression in the wines. We know that because the wines that we made from other properties didn't share that minerality. Does it come from the soil? That's what we would choose to believe. A lot of research is now being done saying it actually has to do more with yeast strains than anything else. Mm-hmm. So that would then perhaps argue that there's microflora on this property that are producing that for us, but obviously doing it on a very consistent basis.
So what is your definition of minerality?
My personal definition of minerality, that's going to be a flavor component that doesn't taste like fruit or wood or something earthy. Mm-hmm. It is akin to salt or stones or something like that, that is really solid object of the earth kind of flavor, as opposed to
savoring, maybe a salinity category.
Exactly.
Okay.
The old Mont Plaisir minerality was much more burnt match, gunflint kind of thing. It transitioned over. The transitional vintages were 2007, 2008, 2009, and those were part Gower, part PMW estate, in increasing amounts of PMW. And if you actually lined those up on the table, you can actually just sort of see that transition in minerality in the wines.
And is that a character that bespeaks age-worthiness as well in your mind?
Well, certainly it's part of the aging ability of the wines. We're very proud of the ageability of the wines. The Chardonnay certainly can do routinely 10 years past the vintage date without seeming tired or old or over the hill. Here at Special Functions, we've opened wines that are 15, 16, 17 years old, and the first impression of them when you look at them is that they are not that old. They certainly don't look.
Even visual cues.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Our winemaker would argue that the unfined, unfiltered methodology helps with that, because the little bit of haze you see in the wines is predominantly suspended lees, so mm-hmm. dead yeast cells, and those apparently make excellent scavengers for oxygen. So anything that gets into the bottle is going to be bound up in the lees before it has the chance to adversely affect any of the color or flavor components.
Fascinating. What about you? Do you have any thoughts on minerality as a quality that, again, has stirred up a lot of debate?
I think that this minerality in these wines is like the backbone to the wine.
It's like a skeleton that creates that structural element,
and then
everything else kind of hinges to that.
That's right. I think I would associate it closely with the acidity as well.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of go together in these Chardonnays. And it is a reflection of the mountain. I called it earlier, but I called it a sort of dusty minerality. There's almost like a texture to it when you raise it to your nose, especially in this one, in this La Carrière. So it's the most profound in this particular wine of what we make. This vineyard actually was planted in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
It is volcanic soil, volcanic mm-hmm. rock. The whole terroir here in Knights Valley on the mountainside here is a lot of volcanic cement, rhyolite rock underneath, great for drainage. And these vines are therefore a little bit stressed. This is all part of the secret of behind these wines. We didn't know we could make Chardonnay when we first started this project. That is where luck plays its part. So, as I said, Helen went and found the first Chardonnay, made some, it was beautiful. And then we decided, well, if we're going to do this, we need to make it, make sure it's our vines. And that's always been part of our approach in terms of long term. And so that's when we planted, we basically started looking on the mountainside, where can we where can we do this? We found this exposed ridge above Le Pavot Vineyard. It's exposed to the marine breeze that's coming from 30 miles away. It's a gentle breeze most of the time. And so we planted the first vines up there in 1990, and that was Bellecote.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.